Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour autobiography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers University Newark. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Yuki Oda has spent most of her life living in a loft space in one of the historic cast iron buildings in the Soho section of New York. She watched her close-knit community of artists grow into an upscale international destination for fashionistas and foodies, and saw many of her creative neighbors move to less pricey sections of the city. The small manufacturers closed down, the local food and bakeries left as well, and the majority of the art galleries moved uptown to the Chelsea area. But Yuki and her family stayed the course. And now she's in the midst of recapturing her old neighborhood by founding the Soho Memory Project that will blend the old and the new. Yuki, welcome.
Thanks.
From sweatshops to silk scarves, from streets without lights to thousands of tourists with high-end credit cards, from creaky and illegal offs to some that included alleged mafia landlords. Yuki, you're a storyteller. Tell us your story.
I grew up in Soho during the 1970s, and when people hear that I grew up in a Soho loft, they imagine that it was so glamorous. But really, it was a childhood unlike any other. I learned to ride my bike in my house. We had absolutely no green space in Soho, so I am afraid of grass.
Grass that grows, not grass that
grows.
You inhale.
Although we did have a lot of grass that you inhale around as well. But it really was a very urban, gritty childhood that was just about the best childhood anybody could have. And now I'm working on a project to preserve that era of Soho and to really tell the history of the area that is now called Soho from the beginning to the present by creating the Soho Memory Project, which eventually, I hope, will be a historical society for Soho that will have a permanent location somewhere on street level in Soho.
Very few people really know the story of Soho. The Soho section of Manhattan, I used to think it was in London. In fact, when you look it up in Wikipedia, that's what you get.
Yes, but there actually is no relation to the Soho of London. The name Soho, many say, came from a report that was written about the South Houston industrial area.
Houston or Houston?
Houston.
Big argument.
Always Houston.
Always Houston.
Never Houston.
Houston people say it's Houston.
They are incorrect, but they are correct about the pronunciation of their home city. When I was growing up, Soho was very different from what it is today. Right now, people know it as a shopping destination or a place where they have expensive lofts and glamorous, famous people live there. But when I was growing up, it was a zoned as an industrial area. It was illegal to work, to live there. So we all lived as if we were sort of camping because we didn't really have legal leases for our spaces.
And how big was your space?
Our space was actually a floor through with windows on four sides. It wasn't huge, though. It was about 2,000 square feet, which made it very difficult to heat. We didn't have heat past 5 o'clock because we were in an industrial building, and I often had to sleep in my coat. We tried to keep out drafts by stapling plastic to our windows.
Why would your father move you to a place like that?
Because my father, who is from Japan, left Japan to be an artist in New York, and that was where he had enough space to do his art, and it was a space that he could afford.
You know, you couldn't buy anything back then unless you were an artist. You couldn't get into those lofts. When things started to get a little exciting and prices went up, then everybody else came in, I guess.
Right. But before that, artists were all living there illegally, and none of them owned their lofts until the early 70s when the laws began to change that allowing artists and artists only certified by the city to live in these lofts and eventually buy them. A lot of the buildings were turned into artists' co-ops, where people would buy a share of the building. And then as time went on, a lot of non-artists slipped through the cracks and bought lofts, and the real estate prices went up.
And up.
And up. And the laws were sort of ignored. And so now we still have a lot of artists living in Soho, but not nearly as many as before. And most artists, working artists, cannot afford to live there anymore.
And you wouldn't be living there if you didn't own your loft, right?
That's true. So thanks to my parents for being so wily and buying their loft before it got out of control.
But your father was a pretty good artist.
He was a pretty good artist, but he was also my mother is also a pretty good businesswoman, and my parents had a construction business and a furniture making business, and they did general contracting for years to put me through college and to buy our loft.
And when you got up in the morning and you walked around the street to Crosby Street, people in Texas won't know what Crosby Street is, and you had a wonderful breakfast, those kind of places were everywhere in Soho, weren't they? Little places.
Little mom and
pop. Mom and pop and grandpa, too.
Yeah, they were there. And even before that, there were coffee shops that were actually only open for breakfast and lunch because most of the neighborhood was factory workers who left to go elsewhere at 5 o'clock. And then everything pretty much shut down. But then slowly other places that catered to the artists opened up, and they became the hubs of the community, and they were great. And now they're all gone, and they've been replaced by high-end boutiques and restaurants that I cannot afford to go to.
My goodness. How do you feel about that?
I actually feel okay about that. It's in the nature of all great cities to change and to develop and to go through different cycles. And this is the way it's gone in Soho. There are many people, especially a lot of old timers, who've tried to keep the development responsible. And I think that's good too. But if a neighborhood and a city didn't evolve, it would die. So, you know, I fit in where I fit in, and my neighbors have changed, and that's okay.
It's never okay to lose something like that. That's a character of New York. I noticed in your biography that you posted that you're a native New Yorker, and it's almost like you're emphasizing that.
I am, and I'm very proud of it.
There aren't too many of you, you know.
I know.
Of us.
I don't meet any anymore, really. I don't know where they all went. Probably couldn't afford to stay.
Well, some of them used to go to Brooklyn. Now they can't afford to go to Brooklyn.
So, yes. But there are the few of us that remain, the few and the proud.
And in a minute, I'd like you to tell me a little bit. Meanwhile, I'll tell everybody else that you're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolfer on WBGO FM 88.3 and WBGO.org. Our guest is Yuki Oda, the founder and driving force of the Soho Memory Project, which is recapturing, updating the story of life in the Soho section of New York City, now one of New York's favorite shopping areas for tourists.
Indeed.
Indeed. So tell us what you're trying to do. Explain what's going to happen.
Well, what I'm trying to do, long-term goal is to establish a historical society for Soho. And the Soho Memory Project, until now, has been a blog and an archive preserving the history of Soho.
But you edit the blog, you write the blog, you're the chief blogger.
Yeah, well, it's an organization of one at the moment. I also collect material for my Soho Memory Archive, tells the story of Soho as it developed from an industrial area.
That's mobile, isn't it? You carry it around? You have some kind of a little...
Well, the archive is actually housed right now in my studio in the basement of the building where I live. But I've created a mobile historical society that will actually be a box that opens on wheels so that we can pop up in different areas in Soho, publicly accessible areas such as stores and restaurants.
So when you push that mobile thing around, you could literally recapture some of the old life in Soho. Someone leaves out a chair, someone leaves out an old newspaper.
Yes.
Have
and
you?
Well, we haven't actually launched that program yet. We are redesigning a mobile reading room that was made by the Uni Project, which is an organization that creates pop-up learning experiences across New York City, and we're making it into a pop-up museum of sorts, a historical society that can just be in many different places. We will actually have the capacity to record interviews with old-timers and newcomers as well about their reflections and thoughts about Soho. And then we will also be presenting the history of Soho in a sort of very accessible, concise display that would cover mostly Soho from 1960 to 1980, but we'll also just start from the beginning, the 1700s, and what the area was like then, and then we'll talk about it all through to the present.
Why is that necessary? Why do you think it's important to do that?
Well, I think it's important to put Soho in the context of the larger history of New York City and to really have people understand that Soho of today is a particular place and time, but that Soho evolved from many different things and through many different cycles to become what it is today. And I think a lot of people visit Soho and they see it as a glamorous and fun place to visit, but they also, I would think, feel a little bit of soullessness if they don't know the context of the neighborhood. And I feel like the more people know about where Soho comes from, the more people will care about the neighborhood and also they'll interact with it differently.
Give us a verbal map of Soho. From here to here, from there to there.
Well, depending on who you are, the borders change. But I would say from Houston down to Canal, and then from West Broadway across to Lafayette.
Soho became well-known for a different reason a long time ago when a young man of 6 years old by the name of Eton Potts was suddenly grabbed off, and not until recently do we really know what happened to him. Maybe we don't know, but you knew. You know the family.
I do.
And they're dealing with that right now. And tell us a little bit about the Eton Potts story, because that's part of the Soho story.
Yes. Well, he was my sister's age, and his older sister is my age. So we sort of ran in the same Soho kid circles. We attended the same cooperative playgroup, which was in a basement on Wooster and Prince Street. I'd been to birthday parties at their house, and I vividly remember when he disappeared and what kind of incredible community mobilization there was around trying to find him and in supporting the family. Nationally, the story is known. Eitan was the first child to be put on a milk carton as a missing child, and it just really was one of the first stories of a missing child that went national. For us, of course, we were saddened and we were shocked and scared.
He was taken on May 25th, 1979, and you were a young child.
I was.
It is scary.
Yes, I was 10. And the neighborhood did change as a result of it.
Your parents didn't want you to walk alone, that kind of
but
thing?
But that's the thing. I think that nationwide, the story was reported as this event that changed everything. But really, when you come down to it, we all had lived our lives as well. So I continued to walk in the streets by myself, and my parents continued to trust me to be able to do that. But everything was just tainted a little bit by the memory of him.
The family went through it. It's been going through a lot. Like, there's been somebody on trial, and no one is really sure whether he was crazy when he did, or whether he did what he did. And I wonder, how are they handling that? How is the community handling that? Because, I mean, you're all sort of part of this story.
Yes. Well, I suppose we're all following the story. I haven't really discussed it with his parents, but I do know that it is a terribly difficult time, especially since the case will be tried again. So the process will have to begin again.
Do you tell your children? You have two children?
I have a daughter who's 7 and a stepdaughter who's 15.
Have you told them that story, just to watch out?
No, I have not told my 7-year-old, but I did tell the 15-year-old. But
it's all part of the memory project, I
it
know.
It is. It is.
And there's a lot to cover. What do you particularly want to cover in addition to all of this stuff that we've been talking about? What do you think people need to know as well as what they want to know?
People need to know that...
You're a storyteller. Says it right here. Through her editing and writing and translation and collage, which I've read, which is very good, and your handbags, which is also very good. It's attracted my wife's eye. And everything that you write about. So give us your narrative, a quick narrative of what you want to accomplish in addition to having a historical perspective of Soho.
I do want to put that historical perspective in the context of the present. I think that knowing the history will inform the way we shape Soho's future. And I think if we can respect where Soho came from, it will give us a little bit more of a reason to respect how we treat it today and what decisions we make moving forward.
Actually, I was thinking about that when I was on the way down here and looking around the city. I used to know all of the places in the city. There are all kinds of landmarks. Maybe your story can help us understand why landmarks should remain landmarks and not be torn down and become something else. Think that's possible? You could tell that story?
Certainly. And especially now that we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Landmarks Law, I think it's very important that we recognize that Soho became what it is today due to efforts to preserve the neighborhood. When it was dying as a manufacturing neighborhood, there were plans to raise the neighborhood and build a middle-income housing project, and there was even a plan put forward by Robert Moses to build an expressway down Broome Street, which would have essentially just flattened the whole neighborhood.
Robert Moses worked for a fellow by the name of Fiorello LaGuardia, and his job was to put as many highways within and without the city, whether you liked it or not.
Right. Well, you know, his future involved everybody having a car and nobody walking in the streets.
Well, now they're using bikes.
Right. Well, bikes are good.
You like bikes?
I like bikes.
Okay. The Soho section of New York was once the major artist district of New York City, and we hope to recapture that again. It was filled with galleries, international renowned artists. Yuki Oda is trying to paint a historical picture through the Soho Memory Project. Go ahead, tell us some more. Nice, fascinating story.
Yes. Well, the other thing that's sort of different about my project from the other archives and library collections that have preserved the stories of Soho artists and art movements that happened in Soho during the 60s and 70s is that I'm concentrating on everyday life and on Soho as a community and as a neighborhood that incidentally had a lot of great art come out of.
And a lot of the great art was, I mean, I knew some people back then and they would leave their easels at the front of their loft because they had to be carpenters in order to be able to paint when they had time to do that.
That's true.
Nothing can be done about that. The artists go in, they reclaim the area, and then suddenly they're replaced or supplanted. Well, and the artist comes in and the place, and you don't have lights like Soho, or you don't have a police because they don't have those lights, and then suddenly it becomes fashionable.
Yes.
And the next thing that happens, the prices go up, and they can't afford it, just the way you wouldn't have been able to afford it if your father wasn't so farsighted.
That's true. And that seems like actually a pattern that can be seen in many different neighborhoods in New York City, in the United States, and probably across the world. Soho was sort of the prototype for a certain kind of for adaptive reuse of buildings, where in a completely industrial neighborhood became a residential neighborhood, and then was developed into high-end real estate. And it seems to a lot of people seem to be trying to emulate that now into other areas in the United States.
It changes New York quite a bit. Where else can you have an area called a restaurant called Food? You miss that, don't you?
Yes, I do miss that restaurant.
The best egg salad in America. Or it was the best egg salad in America.
And carrot cake and soup and whole wheat bread and delicious.
Tell me about the smells and sounds of Soho. You can recreate that right here.
Yes. Well, I actually do recreate it in my portable historical society. I have smell jars that contains the smells of Soho of my childhood. And they include the smell of leather because there were a lot of leather wholesalers along Spring Street and on Mercer Street. And then also the smell of industrial baking. There were many industrial bakers, more of the sort of hostess type and not of the, you know, sort of patisserie type. And there is also a pepper factory on Broome Street. And I have a jar of peppercorns to remind us all that Soho did have this kind of past where there was industry.
One of my favorite stories from your blog was a woman looking out the window and screaming at somebody who wasn't picking up after a dog, yelling, "Go back to New Jersey."
Yes. Well, there were those as well, those people as well.
What do you have that smells good, that sounds good, that is good?
In Soho today?
Yeah.
Well, I think that because Soho is a neighborhood that attracts many tourists, we have the sound of many languages, which is nice. It's nice to have sort of a mix of all different kinds of people with all different kinds of backgrounds.
Well, when you came in, there was a Japanese community, and you're a Japanese.
That's true. My father came to Soho because there was a small community of expatriate Japanese artists living in the area, and one of them was moving back to Japan and offered my father his loft. And that's how we originally got there, or how he originally got there. And there was actually a very diverse community back then as well, but nothing like the visitors we have today.
It explains why you do a collage.
Yes. Well, I think collage is another way of telling a story. I take scraps that are left over from the handbags I used to make, leather and denim and string and canvas, and I make collages that sort of, I think, tell my story. I don't know if it tells any sort of larger story, but it tells my story.
This is about your story.
Yes, yes. And that, you know, that's my story is one small part of the larger story of Soho that I'm trying to tell.
And today, the Soho that you're telling about, people want to know about today. All I see is it's so crowded there. It was a baseball player called Yogi Berra who said that people don't go there anymore because it's too crowded.
Yes. Well, that's not happening right now. It's just getting more and more crowded and more of a popular shopping destination.
There are no food stores. They're just fancy upscale food stores, right? They're just not any stores. It's sort of your neighborhood place where the guy gets the milk because he knows he's seen you every day for maybe 10 years, and so he knows you want a carton of milk.
Right, yes. We used to have that. We used to only have one store, which was a bodega on the corner of West Broadway and Prince Street. And that's where everybody got their quart of milk and other non-perishable foods.
And you also had Marty the Seltzer Man.
And we had Marty the Seltzer Man.
The man from Vietnam.
And he delivered everybody's seltzer. He carried those big boxes of glass bottles up 4, 5, 6 flights of stairs so that you could have seltzer every day. And Marty is actually still around.
What's he doing?
He is one of the street vendors on Prince Street, and he sells T-shirts and seltzer bottles.
He used to deliver to me, I have to tell you, all the way up on 93rd Street. It wasn't always on time, but it was always there. It was always good.
Yes.
I kind of miss that.
That is one of the many things I miss.
You could come to New York, and if you could make it here, you did make it everywhere, right? This was it. This is where everybody wanted to come to, but they could come and they could become something, make something of themselves, no matter how poor they were at the time. It's harder now.
Yes. Oh, so much harder. But and we know that that's true because Soho did launch the careers of many artists and other creative professionals.
Well, you're bringing it all back, so thank you for that. Yuki Oda, your Soho Memory Project is contributing much to the artistic history of New York City. I know many people will want to contribute their stories to your project, and now that you're working with the New York Public Library, it'll even expand even more. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional life with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joanna Wolper is the senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is our executive producer. Conrad Saguinetti is our engineer, and the music is from One More Animal. You can listen to all of our autobiographies by Googling Conversations with Alan Wolper. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.